industries ruled by greed, playing with the world at a reckless speed, and they're burning resources of every nation, ruling the world with their modernization, cause they wanna rule all nations, Arabian, black, white, mix, and Asian, in this case they had no discrimination, ruling the world with capitalization, and a so-called globalization, the way of life, selling you salvation, faith or fear, name your situation. Believe now, cause your life it is so strong it can move mountains off feet. Lighten up now, cause this lifetime is a blessing from above. Yes, it is.
Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and that was Capitalism from the EastEnders. We've got a packed show today, and one that I'm sure you're going to be really, you're going to find really, really interesting. I had a really, really good time preparing for this show. It's a very, stretches a whole, you know, rainbow of whatever, or whatever, a large bridge. I better stop because I'm losing all my ability to use metaphors here. Anyway, at the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with Sabra Williams and Elizabeth Duran from the Actors Gang about the Actors Gang Prison Project. And before that, we'll be talking with Mathis Chereau from the We Are Not Your Soldiers Tour, which is a project of the World Can't Wait organization. But opening the show up is a person and a topic I've been really anxious to get into. And we're going to be talking with Raymond Latta on the Gulf oil spill. Now, everybody's been talking about this, and people know that the explosion of the Deepwater Horizon drilling platform killed 11 workers on April 20th, and it's a massive and perhaps unparalleled environmental disaster. Raymond's a revolutionary intellectual who takes as his foundation Bob Avakian's new synthesis and the work that Bob Avakian has done on exploring the strengths and the weaknesses with socialism in the past, and basically bringing together a whole new vision of how this actually can and should and must develop in the world. And Raymond's written extensively on the experience of socialism, and especially in China during and after the Cultural Revolution. Raymond, welcome to the show.
Hey, Michael, thanks for having me on.
Sure. Boy, this is an incredible thing. You know, I was going to tell people, too, that there's a special issue of Revolution newspaper one called The State of Emergency, The Plunder of Our Planet, The Environmental Catastrophe, and The Real Revolutionary Solution. And you contributed to that. And I thought that a lot of the points that were in here were really in the broad embrace. It actually helped people, helped me put this Gulf oil spill in the proper context, basically, or a way that you could really understand what was going on. And I wanted to talk with you about that. And first off, I thought it'd be interesting to jump into, what are we dealing with here? It's huge, but then there's a question of what exactly is the size and scope? How bad is it? You know, the New York Times the other day ran a thing, or a couple of days ago, ran a thing saying, okay, it's bad, but how bad? And then they kind of understated it. And then there's all kinds of other things going on, but how bad is it? What's the size and scope of this?
Listen, Michael, I think it's very important that having this discussion, that you're focusing on this topic, because the media in the main, you know, are really undervaluing the ecological, you know, impacts of what is happening. As you stated at the top of the show, this threatens to become the world's most devastating oil spill. Right now, what we're dealing with is about 200,000 gallons oil a day that are gushing out of the seafloor from this drilling platform. According to many estimates, it could take as long as 6 months to stanch this leak. And right now, the oil slick has extended over an area of some 3,500 square miles. And the first, sort of the leading edge of that slick, hit the Chandelier Islands, which lie about 60 miles from New Orleans. And the Chandelier Islands are uninhabited, but they're the home to all kinds of endangered species. And the point about this spill is both the magnitude of it, I mean, the gush of this oil, and the fact that it happened in an environmentally sensitive area. That is to say, the spill endangers natural salt marshlands, freshwater ponds, creeks, lakes, and other wetlands that actually make up, you know, the Louisiana Mississippi Delta wetlands make up about 40% of the total U.S. Wetlands, which are very vital to the ecological balances in terms of water, soil, and obviously wildlife. And the Louisiana Department of Wildlife and Fisheries estimates that perhaps 400 species could be impacted by this oil spill. I mean, we're talking about pelicans, river otters, and something else, the beaches of the Louisiana area, some 31 loggerhead turtles, also an endangered species, have washed up dead on those beaches. So this is a very serious problem. They don't have any, right now, they don't have any means to stop this spill. It's gushing. And I think people should understand, I just read an article by a British marine biologist who explained why the prospect of oil pouring into the Gulf for such a period could have such horrifying effects on wildlife. And the point is that the Gulf coastline of Louisiana and the Mississippi Delta consists of a sedimentary shore with lots of muddy inlets, as people probably know. And the spilled oil will penetrate into the mud, and because it contains no oxygen, the oil will not biodegrade. So for generations, any disturbance will bring the oil back to the surface, and this will happen over a very large area and affect wildlife. So think about it. This disaster will have effects for generations, but for companies like British Petroleum, ExxonMobil, Shell, this kind of profit-driven, short-sighted activity is what it means to be corporate pace-setters.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Raymond Latta, a revolutionary intellectual and political economist who is one of the contributors to a special issue of Revolution newspaper titled State of Emergency, The Plunder of Our Planet, The Environmental Catastrophe, and the Real Revolutionary Solution. And we're talking about the huge oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico.
Even in terms of the size and the scope of the thing, there's been a lot of talk about if the currents go a certain way and how this could go around and destroy the coral reefs in South Florida. There's all this other stuff going on. Are you familiar with SkyTruth?
No, tell me.
It's actually an interesting operation. It's a small one-paid staffer somewhere in West Virginia. You know, initially there was this assessment from the government and from BP that they were leaking out 1,000 barrels a day. Well, SkyTruth then said they did a study of the of the satellite photos of the area, and they claim now, they actually say that there's 25,000 barrels a day are leaking out. And the government, in relation to that, that was when the assessment got boosted up from 1,000 to 5,000 barrels a day. And there's people who put a lot of, I mean, I don't know. These guys say that this is a rock bottom assessment, and there's not, they actually have a fairly good track record in terms of estimating these kinds of things. But the point is that there is this thing that's just taken, it's taken as sort of a, you have this mammoth event, which if it is, if SkyTruth is telling, is actually accurate, you already have something that would be the largest oil spill in U.S. history. And the whole way that this is being treated and taken up, I mean, the idea of even, well, the essential thing is who's responsible for paying this, and, oh, we're going to take care of this, and we're going to do this. But then they're already debating out, as if the key question is, and although it shows the character of this and what they really are concerned about, they're already saying things like, well, we'll have to discuss who's going to deal with all the personal lawsuits that come up and all this other stuff, as if this is the question and not the fate of the planet. It's just really outrageous.
Yeah, no, I think it's absolutely right. You know, the Center for Biological Diversity has also estimated that the 200,000 gallons a day that is now pretty much accepted for what's happening is itself low, and it may be up to 1 million gallons a day. So this is already an ecological event of extraordinary magnitude, and it hasn't actually sort of taken off to the environmental level that is sort of built into an oil spill like this. And, you know, the winds are moving in certain directions that have inhibited the actual movement towards the shoreline and coastline. This is what's happening. And as I said, quoting that marine biologist, you know, that oil seeping into the mud is going to have a long-term effect. And that is something that is irreversible in terms of that effect. And this is something that is being, as I said, downplayed in the media right now. And it's interesting, you know, they're talking about the cost of containment, but British Petroleum and the other major oil companies worked hard and spiritedly to block regulations requiring the installation of a device that was called an acoustic swish. They had employed this acoustic swish. What it does is it triggers an underwater valve to shut down a well in the event of a blowout. But British Petroleum and other oil companies found the cost of this unit, which was $500,000, to be excessive. And then you have to weigh that sort of naked cost calculus against the environmental damage. I mean, what is the price tag on the 31 dead loggerhead sea turtles that floated onto the Gulf beaches? What is the price tag on these very fragile ecosystems? That's not part of the sort of the profit loss ledger of these oil companies. They are driven to maximize extraction. They're on an oil rush around the world, and this has been facilitated by the Obama administration. I mean, this is a capitalist oil spill in so many ways. It's not just an oil spill. I mean, these are large transnational corporations that are drilling in the Gulf of Mexico. They're drilling all over the world. And it's very interesting that the Gulf of Mexico, and there was an article in the New York Times about this. Let me just quote from this New York Times article. And it says in this article, most, and I'm quoting from this article, most of the new discoveries in oil lie deep beneath the world's oceans, including in the Gulf of Mexico. And for the oil companies, these reserves are worth hundreds of billions of dollars and represent the industry's future. Since the 1980s, the Gulf of Mexico has turned into a vast laboratory for the industry to test and showcase its most sophisticated technology. I think there's a lot that's packed into that, basically justifying drilling for oil. But what it's saying is hundreds of billions of dollars of investment potential, you know, contained within these offshore deep-sea drilling operations. And when it says in this article that the Gulf of Mexico has been a laboratory, that's not a metaphor. You were talking about metaphors at the beginning of the show. That's actually a fact, that the oil companies have been testing out new equipment, you know, that can drill deeper and further, that can extract more oil from more inaccessible sites. And they go from the Gulf of Mexico to other parts of the world, so that some of the technology that was pioneered in the Gulf of Mexico is now being applied in the Gulf of Guinea off the west coast of Africa. And the west coast of Africa is a potentially rich source of cheap oil. And it's very interesting that, you know, U.S. and international oil companies are there, and that in 2007, the United States established a new African military command, AFRICOM, which coordinates U.S. military activities in all of Africa, with the exception of Egypt. And at the same time, the U.S. is propping up these brutal and corrupt regimes like Nigeria and Equatorial Guinea as part of this global oil strategy, because that part of the world, West Africa, is destined, according to U.S. sort of planning, the imperial planning, to provide about 20% of the U.S.'s oil consumption needs.
If I wanted to explore a little bit more this whole point about the it's a capitalist oil spill, because everything you're saying, put that together with the constant competition, the cost cutting, it's not cost effective to do this, to do that, as well as, I mean, I find it really, you know, you said it, no, you know, there's no means to stop this, and people are talking about an unrelenting volcanic eruption of oil from the seabed, but there's this whole thing that goes on. I mean, even now when you're talking about the Gulf as a lab, I was really surprised to find out that there are 30,000 drilling operations in the Gulf of Mexico right now. And most of them are these deep water drilling operations. It's really very heavy in terms of what you're saying. You said no means to stop it. And you look at the ways that they're experimenting with the experimental means they're trying to develop to stop it now. And they're saying even there, well, if this fails, it could, the worst case scenario could be 60,000 barrels a day coming out, and what that would mean for the planet.
No, I think it's very important what you're saying. That going back to that phrase from the New York Times, you know, this is a laboratory for the oil industry, the Gulf of Mexico. Now, understand, this is a laboratory for deep-sea drilling, not a laboratory for environmental safe activity in the Gulf. They're not testing out, you know, how to protect against an accident like this. In fact, most of what they're throwing into this accident has been untried, untested, but that's the logic of capitalism. You know, they scrimped on all the safety and environmental regulations that they could. They got the green light from the Bush administration with the oil lease. Bush granted BP, British Petroleum, the oil lease, and the Obama administration actually licensed British Petroleum and other companies to undertake the actual drilling. But in licensing them, they got a pass on all the protective measures that really would have to be taken, and they haven't tested these things out. So the laboratory is for deep-sea drilling and not for what is environmentally sensible and adequate and commensurate with what is actually going on. And they should not be drilling. And that is intrinsically dangerous. I was looking at an article about the Minerals Management Service, ostensibly the watchdog, the government watchdog over the oil industry. And they've been granting all the oil companies the right to drill, and they've been foregoing any kind of serious environmental reviews. And it's interesting, when you look at the projected oil activity over the next 5 years from the Minerals Management Service, they build into their scenarios that there are going to be 9 serious oil spills over the next 5 years and 300 smaller oil spills. In other words, this is a given for them. And your point about the drilling operations in the Gulf, I've been told that from the satellites, if you look down on the Gulf of Mexico, it appears like the Milky Way looks to us in the sky. In other words, it just lit up these oil drains.
Wow. Wow, amazing. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Raymond Latta, who is one of the contributors to a recent issue of Revolution Newspaper, which, frankly, is one of the most unique and I think not only important but really unique coverage of the environment. It's called The State of Emergency, The Plunder of Our Planet, The Environmental Catastrophe, and The Real Revolutionary Solution, and this is the April 18th issue of Revolution Newspaper, which is available on the website revcom.us. Raymond, you know, you're saying that it just blows your mind to think about that in terms of the picture you just painted on that. Well, I wanted to talk a little bit more about Obama, and then I wanted to talk about the point that you make around this was preventable. It's not like this couldn't have been prevented. So can we talk about a little bit more about Obama? Because that's also freaking, I think, a lot of people out, this whole idea of, you know, I was reading an article, and I can't remember if it was the LA Times or the New York Times recently, that had an article on the Arctic drilling that Shell is getting ready to undertake in July. And what if something like this happened? And they were doing exactly what you said, factoring in that there's a 40% chance of some kind of accident happening, but they exempted them from having to file an environmental impact thing because the possibility of a really massive accident or spill is so infinitesimal that it wouldn't be worth doing this environmental impact study. And then you get this thing recently where they said, okay, they're going to put a freeze on all new drilling. But then they also made the point that that doesn't mean they're closing down any of the current operations that are going on. They're going to put a freeze on all new drilling, not any of the things that are currently operating. So there's this whole thing that's going on around Obama does these really outrageous things. And where's the uproar around this? And I thought, you know, there is some stuff that Obama has done that has just been so ludicrous and outrageous around this thing, even saying that, you know, the drilling doesn't cause oil spills. It's the refineries on the ground and all that stuff. So can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, yeah. I mean, as I said, there is this mad rush, you know, globally, you know, to seize control of new sources of oil, natural gas and coal, that is, the non-renewable energy sources. And, you know, let me just give you a few statistics. These, I think, are very telling. They're not the boring kind of statistics. Of the 10 largest companies in the world in 2007, six were oil companies and three were car companies. In other words, fossil fuel and private automobile transport are deeply embedded in the structures of capitalist production and expansion. And let me give another statistic that your listeners will certainly appreciate if they've not yet heard it, and that is that the U.S. military is the single largest purchaser of oil in the world, the single largest institutional purchaser of oil in the world. And if the war in Iraq were ranked as a country in terms of carbon emissions, well, then that war is emitting more carbon dioxide each year than the 139 countries of the world in the aggregate do. So in other words, oil is integral to the maintenance, to the defense, and the extension of the U.S. empire. So, you know, this is so deeply bound up with how capitalism functions and the rivalry between the great powers for control of energy sources. So then when Obama, as president, lifts a decades-long moratorium on offshore drilling, this is what Obama did. And then that famous and scandalous statement, and what Obama said was, oil rigs today generally don't cause spills. That's what President Obama said in connection with lifting this moratorium on offshore drilling, which is going to result in more drilling in the Gulf, offshore of Alaska, along the Atlantic coast, from Florida up to Maryland. And then you have to say, well, why? Why did he do that? You know, if the Bush administration had done that, you know, people would be in high dudgeon right now. If Bush had made the statement, oil rigs today generally don't cause spills, people would be in a state of outrage and just uproar. But, you know, Obama has done this, and he's saying that this is all part of the diversification strategy of the United States. But that diversification strategy is more drilling in more inaccessible places, more nuclear power, more so-called clean coal. And this is all part of the fabric, as I said, of the functioning of the whole capitalist economy on a world scale. World capitalism is fueled by cheap and profitable fossil fuels. And that's why the Department of Energy in 2009 estimated that in 2030, that is in 2 decades from now, oil, natural gas, and coal will make up about 80% of the U.S.'s primary energy supply, which is pretty much the percentage today, because, again, extracting oil, coal, and gas is tremendously profitable.
Raymond, we have time for one more question, and I want it to be this one. You're a communist, and the idea that, well, people saying the argument could be advanced is, well, this is just sort of, this just happens. If you're going to use oil, if you're going to drill for oil, this just happens. What would a communist society, what would a socialist society do differently, both in terms of prevention, but also, well, how would it do things differently than this fanatical, insane drilling for oil, the drive for profit, the desire to control the world, all this other stuff? What would a socialist country do differently?
I mean, the first point is that a socialist society and economy would be organized around totally different principles. A socialist society would unfold its priorities from the needs of liberating and emancipating humanity overall and protecting the ecosystems of the planet. That's the first point, that the protection of the planet would be integral to the functioning and to the mission of a socialist society. This is completely different from a capitalist society, which puts profit first and which is driven by this need, this necessity to expand or die. A socialist society would be based on social ownership of all the means of production, of producing the wealth. It would be organized on the basis of cooperation, and it would be deploying all of its skills, resources, and capabilities to do this useful and important for the betterment of humanity and the protection of the planet. So that's the first point. It would be organized on a whole different... There wouldn't be an ExxonMobil. There wouldn't be Walmart that's polluting out of China through its subcontracting networks. There wouldn't be an imperialist military machine raining death and destruction. So that's the first point. It would be organized along wholly different lines, and it would move very decisively and urgently off of fossil fuels to renewable energies like geothermal, solar. Those technologies exist, but they're not profitable in this system. So we can develop a rational, socially just, and environmentally sustainable economy and society. So that would be the orientation in terms of the very starting point of that economy. We'd move away from this kind of transport system, this kind of agricultural system that relies on all these petrochemical inputs. We would be talking about creating different kinds of cities, Michael. People should go to our special issue of RevCom.us, that special environmental emergency issue. We talk about a whole different urban grid, cities that are sustainable, more capable of producing to meet basic needs and requirements, including efforts to develop local urban food production. We're talking about a society that would be promoting values and imbuing people with a sense of their responsibility to be the custodians of the planet. So, you know, we could actually deal with these questions. We could do that by unleashing all the energy and the know-how and the commitment of broad sections of people. You know, the scientists know what has to be done. You know, the ecological scientists, the marine biologists, but they're blocked. You know, they're running into walls because, you know, the system is not based on what's good for humanity and what's good for the planet.
Okay, and on that note, we're going to have to wrap it up, Raymond. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Michael, sure. And this is an important discussion, and it's very important that you're featuring this kind of discussion because people have not really heard the truth of what is going on and the important point that there is a whole other way that we can organize society. We do not have to live in this kind of economy and world.
Exactly. Thank you again, Raymond. Take care.
Thank you for having me.
And again, you can get that special issue of Revolution Newspaper, State of Emergency, The Plunder of Our Planet, The Environmental Catastrophe, and the Real Revolutionary Solution at RevCom.us. That was Raymond Lada, a communist intellectual who was a contributor to that special issue, and he's also written quite a bit about the socialist experience in the Soviet Union and China and what it could be based on the work that Bob Avakian has done to re-envision this whole idea of socialism and communism. We're going to take a quick break and be right back with Mathis Shiro from the We Are Not Your Soldiers tour.
Kim and John Army, cause you had no place to go. There ain't nobody hiring here since I'm jumping down to Mexico. Reckon that learning self-trade made me see the world. City someday, married a black-haired girl. Somebody somewhere had another plan. Now he's got a rifle in his hand. then wondering how it got this far. Just another poor boy out to fight a rich man's war.
All right, welcome back. That's Steve Earle with Rich Man's War from The Revolution Starts Now. Coming up later in the show, we'll be talking with Sabra Williams and Elizabeth Duran from the Actors Gang about the Actors Gang Prison Project. But joining us now is Mathis Chereau from the We Are Not Your Soldiers tour from the World Can't Wait organization. Mathis is a former U.S. Army sergeant who refused deployment to Iraq and actually fought it out and got a honorable discharge on that basis, and actually was a great victory for a lot of resistors in the military who refused to be sent off to fight an immoral war. Mathis, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
Here.
Well, why don't you tell us first off, what is this We Are Not Your Soldiers tour?
Okay, sure. Well, the We Are Not Your Soldiers tour, first of all, I guess in its conception, identified the fact that as far as high school students are concerned, military recruiters have gained an unfettered level of access directly to our nation's youth. This is in great part because of the No Child Left Behind Act, which mandated that any public school who wanted to draw funding from the federal government had to turn over all their students' information to recruiters. We see this as an extraordinarily unfair and even dishonest tactic by the military and the government to recruit young people without giving them a real perspective of both sides. And most young people have had some contact with recruiters with the message of the military being a place to attain manhood or benefits or serve your country or whatever, but they've never been exposed to the opposite side of that argument, which is more the We Are Not Your Soldiers and the Iraq Veterans Against the War argument of, look, the military is a horrible experience. It is torture. Here are firsthand stories from soldiers and veterans and from all services about their experiences, which were extraordinarily different than what they were told by their recruiters. So it's a project to really not only inform young people about the realities of military service that they are not receiving from recruiters, but also to organize them into some type of resistance movement against these recruiters who do have unfettered access to their campuses according to the law, and will only leave when there is resistance being faced at the school.
Well, now, you go to schools. Do you go to high schools and colleges?
We do. It's a tour primarily focused on high school students as they are primarily the victims of these recruiters. College students we certainly talk to as well to inform about the issues and the reality of the experiences, and certainly discourage people at the university level from joining the military. But as far as the recruiters are concerned, their primary target audience is high school students. So we are going to that place to try and shut down their conveyor belt of people they're forcing into situations like what we've been sharing with students in classrooms, events such as what were depicted in the WikiLeaks video, where we see U.S. soldiers opening fire on civilians. All of this information really helps both high school students and college students, A, to understand the realities of what's going on, and B, understand why they have no business supporting the wars or the military.
What kind of response do you get to showing the WikiLeaks video?
Well, it's shocking. It's absolutely shocking to most. And, you know, we spoke in 7 different classrooms yesterday, and every single classroom leading up to watching this video said things like, yeah, we play, you know, military-type video games all the time. You know, we play, like, helicopter simulator video games. And so you would think that this would yield a sense of desensitization. However, when we shared this video, every single class responded with nothing short of shock and awe. And it's even further, I think, impactful for them to have somebody like myself, a veteran, say, you know, this is very shocking to you. I understand that, but this is not shocking to me, and this is not shocking to veterans, and this is not shocking to active duty troops, and that is a shocking problem.
What's the biggest question that you get? Some of the biggest questions that you get from these high school kids? Because I can imagine, I mean, look, I know when my son graduated from high school, and right before he graduated, there was a career night, and my wife and I went to the career night, and it was a high school that was mainly immigrants and mainly poor people not only was it mainly the military, there, I think there were two junior colleges that showed up, and then the others was the military, but actually it was the Marines and the Army, and because the Navy and the Air Force considered these students to be not worth their bother. So it's just get the grunts in the Marines and the Army. And, you know, it's something that hammers at people all the time. And I was reading a report that you did, I guess it was on the World Can't Wait website, about being at one high school where the students, as they were talking with you or right after they spoke with you, went out and they were confronted by a wall of 15 recruiters outside the high school. You know, what you think, if people don't understand that the way that the military and the system is preying on these high school youth to get them to be the sort of the meat to carry out their wars and to be killed. But mainly, you know, this whole point about we're going to rape the world and you're going to be the rapist. What kind of, it's something you're really going up against something in relation to that, because then the recruiters do come in and you guys, and I should tell people that Mathis Shiro is also on the board of directors of Iraq Veterans Against the War, and you guys put out a flyer or a pamphlet. The World Can't Wait put out this flyer and pamphlet that was talking about what they actually are doing there. And Iraq Veterans Against the War put out a flyer or a statement, a page that said the lies that the recruiters tell you. And this is what they tell these kids, like you're saying, that you're going to get training, you're going to do this, you're going to do that. We can promise you won't go to Iraq or Afghanistan. You won't be carrying out this. You won't be in any danger. You won't be carrying out, you know, war crimes against humanity in other countries. You won't be meeting interesting people and killing them. So you come in there, and then you confront these kids with the truth. What are the questions that they have for you?
Well, it's very interesting. The initial questions, I think, line up very closely with a lot of the misinformation they're fed to by recruiters. Usually when we first walk into a class, the first questions involve, well, what's the military life really like? What are the benefits? Do they really pay for college? Do they really pay for this or that? So initially, they're primarily focused on, like, quality of life issues and what kind of benefits the military may or may not actually give them. And, of course, we respond honestly to that. But as these presentations go on, and we really get into the meat and potatoes of what it is to serve in the military, from murder, rape, torture, and war, to the experiences, the dehumanizing experiences soldiers go through, the things they do to others, you know, even issues we've been talking about the fact that 1 in 3 women in the military get raped, and 1 in 2 get sexually assaulted. After we share this information, the questions radically shift from being based around benefits and what can the military do to me, to really questions of how can soldiers do these things? What is the process that they go through that allows them to do things like target civilians in Iraq, to shoot children and then blame it on the Iraqis for bringing their kids into a combat zone, despite the fact that we brought the combat zone to them? As we go through these presentations, the young people definitely hear the experiences of myself and other veterans on the tour, and it really shifts them to the point where I think just about every response that we got from every single class that we went to yesterday was, I am not going to join the military no matter what. And this is encouraging. We have such an intelligent young generation of youth coming up in this country who are not only book smart, but who are street smart. However, they've been deprived of reality when it comes to the military. They've been fed a romantic lie, and when that lie is exposed to them as dishonest, they rapidly readjust their stances, and further, many seem to have been radicalized and extremely passionate about the idea of getting involved in a resistance movement, not just refusing to join the military, but actually getting involved in resisting the military. And that's part one of the reasons why this tour specifically is so very powerful, because we're not just trying to keep kids out of the military. We're trying to impart to them that they bear responsibility for these wars as well, and not joining the military isn't enough. That if they really oppose what's going on, then they need to get involved, and they need to talk to their friends, and they need to confront recruiters, and they need to push this message forward. You know, it's so interesting. We were talking to them yesterday about the average age of people in Afghanistan, of U.S. soldiers in Afghanistan. It's 19. And it really shocked people when I looked at them, because a lot of them thought, you know, these wars really aren't relevant to us. You know, I was so young when September 11th happened and so on and so forth. But when you make the point that, look, the average age of a soldier in Afghanistan is 19, when this war started, they were 10. They were 10 years old. these young people really grab a hold of that and understand that endless war affects everybody and will not stop until we resist it.
Really important points here. And one thing I'd like to, and I sort of as we get ready to wind this down, one of the things I wanted to ask you is, you talked about this point about a big part of your tour is to actually generate resistance to the military and to the military recruiters. Have you seen any of that develop?
I have seen it spontaneously develop. It is incredibly powerful, especially for me as a veteran who does feel traumatized by what I went through, to see that IA can be understood by young people as the military told me I never would be, is very powerful. And then to see a spontaneous spirit of resistance ignite within them. It was the first class that we did on this specific leg of the tour. We were up in San Francisco, and after the first half of the presentation, actually, a couple of students went up the hall and pulled a recruiting poster off the wall and came back to class, and at the beginning of the second half, tore that recruiting poster up in front of everybody. And this resulted in an eruption of excitement and applause for students who are ready to put themselves out there for justice.
All right, Matt, that's a very good way to end this segment of the show. Really, really, really important. And your tour is going for people who are in other parts of the country. How can they get hold of you and find out about bringing the tour to where they are?
Well, they can contact the World Can't Wait. They can check out worldcantwait.org. This tour has been around, I think, almost the entire country, countless states, and we continue to try and organize events locally, even when we can't do a broader national tour. And we have a lot of requests coming in for this, and we're happy to see more requests coming in, and we're happy to fill those requests, because these are messages that the young people are not getting. They're not getting it from their teachers, they're not getting it from the recruiters, they're not getting it from the media. And at least I feel, as a veteran of these war crimes, that it's a responsibility to reach as many of them as possible. So if people want this tour at their schools, they should contact the World Can't Wait and request it, and we will make that happen.
All right, Mathis, thank you very much, and keep up the work, man. It's extremely important. I can't emphasize that too much.
Okay, right before I go, I'm going to actually leave a number, too. If people would like to call 347-385-2195, that is the direct line to the We Are Not Your Soldiers tour. And
Okay, give it again slowly.
347-385-2195, and we are happy to hear from any and all people who are interested in bringing this tour to their school.
Okay, Mathis Chereau from the World Can't Wait's Project We Are Not Your Soldiers tour, and a member of the board of directors of Iraq Veterans Against the War. Mathis, thanks a lot, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Thank you very much.
Okay, take care now.
You're listening to the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. We're going to take a quick break and be right back to talk with members of the Actors Gang Theater Group about the Actors Gang Prison Project, so stay tuned.
Bring me all of your dreams, you dreamers. Bring me all of your heart melodies that I may wrap them in a blue cloud cloth away from the two rough fingers of the world. And that is what poetry may do, wrap up your dreams, protect and preserve them and hold them until maybe they come true. Columbus dreamed of finding a new world. He found it. Edison dreamed of light, more light, and he made light. All the progress that human beings have made on this old earth of ours grew out of dreams. That is why it is wise, I should think, to hold fast to dreams. For if dreams die, life is a broken-winged bird that cannot fly. Hold fast to dreams, for when dreams go, life is a barren field, frozen with snow.
That was Langston Hughes with Dreams, and I thought that was extremely appropriate for our next segment of the show. I want to welcome to the show Elizabeth Doran and Sabra Williams from the Actors Gang Prison Project. Welcome to both of you, Elizabeth.
Thank you, Sabra.
Thank you. Sure. Well, why don't we, since we're going to be really pressed to get everything in this short period of time, first tell us about, and you'll have to identify yourself as you go along unless I call on you, but tell us about the Prison Project. What is the Actors Gang Prison Project?
Well,
Sabra.
The Actors Gang Prison Project is an idea that came up about 3 years ago. When I joined the Actors Gang, I'd come from the UK where I'd worked with the English Shakespeare Company, and we had a prison program there. And then I worked with London Shakespeare Workout, which also works in prisons. doing Shakespeare in prison. So when I came to the Actors Gang and I saw the techniques we use, which is based on Commedia dell'arte, which is a 16th century, the roots of theatre, really. And you see it a lot with white face and mask, kind of very extreme stylized physical theatre. I thought that it would work for rehabilitation in prisons. So I asked to be part of their prison project, and I was told, in typical Actors Gang style, we don't have one. If you want to do it yourself. So I did, and we started, and as the great ensemble that we are, a lot of people have worked very hard to make it the success that it is.
And Elizabeth, your role in all this?
I'm the managing director, so I lead the business aspects of the theater and help to plan its future strategically with our artistic director, Tim Robbins. And I love the Prison Project because whether you look at prison as a place of rehabilitation or a place of punishment, regardless, these guys and these women are coming back into our communities at some point. And under normal circumstances, they may be returning, getting jobs, again, becoming our neighbors and succeeding. But under these circumstances, economically and in our society, people are going back in. You know, there's a great recidivism rate of returning to prison. And there's a lot of violence within the prisons. And I think that the Actors Gang's Prison Project is one way to help to battle that recidivism and to battle the in-prison violence that people are suffering through, again, the kind of work that we do, which is heavily emotionally based.
Now, Sabra, there was a point I read that was actually really fascinating about the impact of, at least what you can judge sort of statistically, the impact of the Prison Project on the recidivism, you know, which I thought was very interesting because I think you guys have made a point that there was a dramatically lower amount of people going back into prison once they've been released among the people who actually took part in the Prison Project.
Yeah, there's a 51% recidivism dropped by people who have arts in corrections, mm-hmm. which, as most people know, has just been discarded by the state of California.
Well, no, people don't know that. Let's actually talk about that, because I found that, look, one thing, I mean, my view on prison, I just had Michelle Alexander on the show last week, who wrote the book The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness, you know, and she basically pointed out that, look, there's a whole caste, an undercast, a racialized undercast that's been created through the war on drugs and purposely created by the system to, you know, you have more black men, for instance, under the control of the criminal justice system than were enslaved in 1850. Pretty damning statistic, you know, and you have this, and then even when they get out, I mean, there's a whole dehumanization. You know, so people in prison are dehumanized, and when they get out, they're dehumanized, they're set into this permanent undercast. And in prison in particular, I always think back to the Attica brothers when they had their rebellion and they made that statement. Mm-hmm. They began their call with, we are human beings and we mm-hmm. refuse and we demand to be treated as such. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the point being that from the moment you hear that cell door slam in the beginning until the end, you are treated as less than human. And that's why I thought the Langston Hughes thing about dreams, if your dreams go away, what happens to you?
Yeah, and I think that that's the main thing with the Prison Project, is that we treat people as humans. You know, that's what the main response we get from the inmates is, it's the first time I feel like I've been treated as a human. Because one of the most damaging things as well about our prisons is that they're segregated, supposedly to stop violence. But what that means is, if you're a young, say, black guy that goes in for a minor drug offense, I've been told by the guys, when you go into prison, you get given a shank, a prison-made knife, and you're told to stab that guy or else we stab you. And once you do that, you then have a gang affiliation. So to survive in prison, you end up with a much, much worse life. And, you know, you're segregated the whole time, not in our classes. We don't have segregation in our classes. And it seems to me so simple and so inexpensive to do what we do. And in the 8 weeks that we work with these guys of all different races, we treat them all the same. The biggest change they notice is that they say, everybody in this room is my brother, more than my gang. And that is a huge statement. So many of the inmates say, this is like bringing down apartheid. You don't understand how huge this is politically. Because when we, you know, go out, we only have our gang. So the fact that these guys are my brothers more than my gang in 8 weeks of transformative work. And, you know, we're not going, the thing that really annoys me is people say, oh, you actors, you're going into prisons to entertain people who've been bad. You know, I live in LA. I live where 40,000 inmates are coming out who have no rehabilitation, little to no rehabilitation. I don't want to live in that society. I want people to have the opportunity to transform their lives. And I know as an actor, when I do this work, it transforms me when I work on stage as an actor trying to reveal a character. So I figure, in my simplistic way, if they do that too, it might transform them. And it does.
And then if I may, in the prisons, as in outside of the communities, I think the work that we're doing is transformational, because we're told by these guys there are a lot of influences in prison, and that they begin to realize through our work that they are their own influence. Yeah. And the prison guards tell us that we have made an impact. There was a guy there, an officer in one of the prisons that I went into, who said to me, "I am as right-wing as you can get, and I am your biggest advocate. Because when you leave, I see the results of what you've done on these men. The in-prison disciplinary issues are down, and these guys have begun to have a sense of self-esteem. And so they're growing some self-awareness that they had either not brought in with them, or they've had to protect themselves through becoming more like a rock emotionally, you know, over time in the prison. And so when we work with these emotions, we help them to find a way to control themselves too.
And it's so hard work. I mean, it's very, you know, very uncompromising. Like, we don't let them off. You know, even on the last presentation that we did on the last day after 8 weeks, like two or three of them were like, "Yeah, I can't do this in front of my peers. They're going to laugh at me. I'm going to get bullied. You know, it's dangerous for us to stand up and be different in this environment." And I was like, "You made a promise to yourself. You think back from the beginning to this day when you're about to face your peers and show them what we've been doing. Think about the difference in you and then make a decision. And then it's up to you." And every one of them did it and loved it. And, you know, the whole room was in tears, including other inmates. It's pretty incredible.
Now, tell me this, because I don't want to get caught up at the end without having spoken to this. You made a comment that, well, everybody knows the arts is being cut. What's actually happening with the arts in the prisons and with your project in particular?
Well, let me say that in California, prisons have replaced colleges as institutions of priority. If you look at the budget, that there is $3 billion more going into prison than going into the University of California and the California State University system combined. So there's money going into prisons. But that spending is barely covering basic needs like health care and, you know, safety. And there are prisons that are 200% overcrowded. There are prisons where people are being kept in gymnasiums. You can't even keep 10th graders in gymnasiums without having people, you know, break into fights, you know.
And they cut all the artist facilitators
right.
in
and
all so the California
And yet the arts
prisons.
Has been cut in these prisons. And we don't ask for money from the prisons to go in anyway. But we need to raise money from our community to send us in. So, of course, you could go online, www.theactorsgang.com, and hit donate now, and you can specifically donate to the prison project.
And we do our work fundraising as well. You know, we're trying to get grants. It's so hard to get grants to work in prison. So most of our money is, you know, donations and fundraising that we've done. And we actually have a show coming up at the Actors Gang called All Cake, No File, which is brilliant and hilarious, by Donna Jo Thorndale. And that's coming up, and she has a Johnny Cash tribute band called With a Bible and a Gun, and she cooks on stage. She plays this hilarious character called Jewel Ray Jeffers, and she actually makes cakes on stage with audience participation. It is the greatest fun you can have, and the money she's raising is going, because she's part of my team that goes into prison, so it's going to the prison project.
Mm-hmm. So if
and
I
everyone gets to eat cake.
I was just going to, you know, that was the most important part of it to me.
You can have your cake and eat it too.
There you go. Now, let me ask you this as a final, I know we're very short on time, but as a final question, what is the status of the prison project right now?
Well, we finished going, we went to a women's prison last year, and then we went back to our, I guess it's called our home prison in Norco, the California Rehabilitation Center. It costs us money just for gas and stuff to go in there. We're not in a position now where we can be in prison. We can't afford to go in right now. I base everything I do on my philosophy of life. I'm a Buddhist, so I believe in cause and effect. And I believe that by making the causes we have to transform these guys' life, that the money will come. It always has done. But we are reaching out for help. And, you know, we're applying for grants all the time. I know Elizabeth is working very hard on that. Right. But, you know, this is essential work, and especially now there's, like, little to no rehabilitation and putting out 40,000 prisoners out onto the street.
Well, and the fact that, look, I mean, if you look at just the way the prison population is increasing, I mean, it's quintupled in just over a period of a few short decades. It's quintupled. Yeah. You know, you have one of the largest incarceration rates in the world, if not the largest. And half of the people, 2 million people in prison, half of them are black.
Right. Yeah.
You know, and this is outrageous when you think about what's actually being done here. And the dehumanizing and the idea that people should not be allowed to think, that they should, you know, and frankly, you know, I mean, like I said, prison to me is not about rehabilitation. It's about dehumanization.
Right now it is, and warehousing, and, you know, people are coming out into a recession, and they're supposed to compete with people who have university degrees and stuff to get a job. But, you know, I know we might just be a drop in the ocean, but I really see that we are making a difference.
All right. Fortunately, I have to wrap it up. I keep watching the clock. No, pull it back.
We'll come back.
Okay. Yes, thank you for having us.
That'll be good. Well, so I want to thank you, Sabra Williams and Elizabeth Duran, is it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I want to thank both of you, and we'll keep up on the Actors Gang Prison Project and everything else you're doing. And definitely, I'll have somebody on to talk about that show, because I'm really interested in eating cake.
Okay? Who isn't? Thank you for your support.
Okay.
Now, regular listeners to the show know by now that each week I like to close things down by talking about how the world doesn't have to be this way, that it not only must change, but that it can be changed. So this week, after all we've been talking about today, I want to close it down with a short piece on the subject from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, a voice that isn't heard enough in the world today. This piece is called A Better World is Possible.
So for capitalism and every system based on exploitation and oppression, the only kinds of ideas it can produce and the kinds of ideas it promotes as the ruling ideas are, not surprisingly, ideas that justify all this exploitation and oppression, that teach people that this is the natural order of things, and that encourage people to try to become big dogs in this dog-eat-dog world. If this kind of world, this kind of system, if this were all that is possible, that'd be one thing. And you see people, even those who are brutally oppressed under this system, as long as they believe this is the only kind of world that's possible, you see them going along with this all the time. I got to get mine. I got to get what I can get within this. It's time to get yours. This reminds me of the story of the prisons in California, and in particular what was called the Corcoran Shoe, where the guards there would take prisoners and they'd tell them stories about each other, get them angry at each other. And they'd literally put them in pens, like in the old Roman Colosseum. And they'd let them out of the pens, and they'd come in and start fighting with each other, sometimes to the death. And the guards would be standing above watching all this, laughing and betting on the outcome. And if it got out of hand, they'd shoot one or more of the prisoners. This was a whole scandal that finally broke into the open in the California prisons. Well, if you just look from inside that, here you are, and the door opens, and you run out in this arena, and you start throwing hands and everything else you can with the other person who's there, you might say, I'm a bad mother. I'm handling this situation. But if you back the camera up a little bit and look at the larger picture, what's happening? You're being handled. You're being put in this horrible situation by these people standing above you, laughing, betting, and ready to kill you if they see it in their interest. And that's a miniature picture, a microcosm, as they say, of what the world is like today, and the way that people get caught up in going along with this. You hear these people say, you know, I'm on this corner selling my product. I'm regulating the corner. You ain't regulating shit. You're just being regulated. You're just being put there and allowed to be there as long as what you're doing serves the people who really regulate things, who really run this system, for as long as it serves them or doesn't get in their way. You hear people say, sometimes they get caught up in all this stuff about the hood. This is our hood. Can't nobody come in here and take over our hood. This is not your hood. You don't own this. You don't run it. You don't control it. The people who own it and run it and control it are just using you. They're just letting you be played like this and carry on with all this foolishness and dangerous stuff, killing each other off because it serves their interests. While they're keeping you in these miserable conditions, not really different than the prisoners in the Corcoran Shoe. It makes me think of a situation where you walk into a scene where there's a man got a gun in one hand and a big club in the other, and he's got everybody lined up. And he goes down the line breaking everybody's legs. And somebody jumps up and says, "All right, then, I'm going to be the baddest broke leg mother there is. Something's wrong here." What we need to be doing is say, "Hey, that man's breaking everybody's leg. Let's get together and stop that mother from breaking everybody's leg." Now, I understand how people try to make the best of their circumstances. They say, "You didn't give me nothing else. You didn't leave me nothing else. So I'm going to take this, and at least this way I can get some respect before I go out." So we can understand this. But again, let's step back and look at the larger picture, the larger world. Because we, the masses of people, are capable of much greater things than this. We are capable of completely and radically changing our circumstances, changing all of society to get rid of circumstances like these. What happens in the world affects us, and we can affect the world. And when all is said and done, we can change the whole world together with people like us all over the world.
Once again, that was an excerpt from a speech by Bob Avakian. The entire talk, Revolution, Why It's Necessary, Why It's Possible, and What It's All About, is available in its entirety at revolutiontalk.net. I want to thank all of my guests today, my production assistants Henry Carson and Age, and my engineer Melissa Figueroa. And most of all, I want to thank all of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. I'll be back to talk with you again next week. Until then, we're going out with a cover of The Clash's Straight to Hell, and this is done by Lily Allen and Mick Jones.
If you can play on the fiddle, how's about a British jig and reel? Go straight to hell.